The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley, and we are streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, to reach us on the show, boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And a reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging, and to learn more about Kendall, which is spelled K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit www.discoverkendall.org or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. We are very pleased, I hope, in the magic of Tony, our producer in electronics, to welcome Deborah Dunn to the show. Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Hi. Welcome. Welcome to Boomer Generation Radio, and thank you. Let me get this out of the way. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on, and a thank you to Evan Neeson from Compassion and Choices as well. The subject of this first segment is something that's right out of the newspaper and the topical headlines really around the country in the last several months. In the state of New Jersey, where I live, we have a bill, a choice in dying bill, sponsored by Assemblyman Berticelli of Gloucester County, who is scheduled to be on today and had to rearrange things because of his commitments to the Assembly. And again, Deborah, thank you for coming in. The bill is modeled after the Oregon bill, and really this is part of a rising tide of conversation about choice in dying. And so Compassion and Choices is a national organization that deals with this, and Deborah, again, let me thank you for coming on, and let me ask you straight away to sort of like lay the foundation. Could you tell our audience what Compassion and Choices is, how it evolved, and what its major focus is?
Okay. I am a volunteer for them, so I don't really work with them, so I will generally describe what it is.
Great.
Compassion and Choices evolved into the organization that it is today. It's about helping people with living wills and things of that nature toward the end of life, so that people's choices can be respected when they're not able to speak for themselves. So they have people available to help people who want to write a living will, for example, or talk about how to handle at the end of their life, how they want to move forward. The initiative kicked off a long time ago, a number of years ago, in Oregon, which now has passed the bill, and it has an aid in dying bill where a person who is of sound mind, they're with it, who is an adult, and they are able to ingest medication on their own, and they decide that it's the end of their life. They've been told they have 6 months or less to live. They can then go to a physician who is amenable to prescribing medication that will help end their life. If a physician is not interested in doing that, then, of course, he does not do that. They find a physician who is amenable to doing that. They then have the choice to purchase this medication or not. If they get the medication, it has to be documented with a number of physicians, so I don't know the exact procedure that it happens, but there's more than one physician involved. And then the person has the physical medication in their hand, and many times most people do not even take the medication. Many people do not even fill the prescription.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about sense of control and being able to have the sense of being in charge of your life, and very few people actually end up taking the medication. So you have to be terminally ill, and that is declared by a physician, and that's with 6 months or less to live. So it's not like anybody on the street can go ahead and pick up medication, have a doctor write a prescription, and it's all said and done. But for people who are terminal, who have tried, if they have cancer, if they've tried radiation, chemotherapy, or any other modality, holistic medicine to, you know, prolong their life, to kill off the cancer cells, and they reach the end of their lives and they realize that there are no other options now. They are failing at a rapid rate, and they do not choose to live in this situation anymore.
So this, again, as you said, is modeled after the Oregon bill, and there are about five states that have already passed such legislation, and a bunch of them are considering it, like New Jersey.
Correct.
And this bill passed the Assembly, I think, was 41-31 vote.
Correct.
About 3 weeks ago, and is supposedly making its way across the aisle over to the Senate.
Right.
So, I guess the next question really is, you volunteer, as you said, for Compassion and Choices, which is this national organization that is involved with education and lobbying efforts for such bills. What brought you to this? Why this issue? Why now? Why you?
About a year and a half ago, actually almost 2 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He was an OR nurse. So for the first month, he was in the hospital. The second 3 months, he was at home. And my sister, my mother, my brother, my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, we all chipped in and stayed with my husband Monday through Friday, and I went to part-time work.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, he went to chemo. He wanted to fight the cancer. Surgery was not an option. And so he valiantly went to chemo once a week, which also has its negative side effects, which are not pleasant. At the end of 3 months, the doctor said, it's not working. Even though the cancer hadn't gotten worse, according to the CAT scan, his symptoms had gotten worse, and he was failing. So we had a conversation and decided that he would do hospice at home. So we did hospice. He had been getting, I'm an OR nurse. So all that time, I was shown how to give him TPN, which is an IV solution that has lipids, which is fat, protein, nutrition, vitamins, minerals in it. He got that fluid over an eight-hour period every night through an IV line, a PIC line that he had.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kept him alive for 3 months. When he went into hospice, he was no longer allowed to have that. That's part of hospice. Hospice is end-of-life care, not prolonging life. And that TPN fluid would prolong life, which it did. So when he went into hospice, he was not allowed to have that, but he was allowed to drink. While he was in the hospital for that month prior to coming home, he had been given a tube into his stomach because the food, well, he wasn't eating anymore, the liquid that he was drinking could not pass through his intestines. It was completely blocked off by the tumor or the tumors. So he was given a tube, which is normally a feeding tube that you feed people, that comes out of the stomach, out of the abdomen, and that's how you feed people. In his case, it was to allow the fluid that went into his stomach to come out, and it went into a bag. So it was the reverse of a feeding tube.
Mm-hmm.
So he was allowed to drink in the house, but of course it didn't do anything because it all just came right out. The doctor said within a week he would not live. More than a week. He lived 2 weeks, and it was unpleasant. It was actually worse than unpleasant. It was horrible. He had lost in the course of 3 months a lot of weight. He was 6 feet tall. By the end, when he died, he was 125 pounds. So he lost a lot of weight, and he was very unhappy. He said 3 times he wanted to die, and there was nothing I could do because we have no law. The bill, I didn't even know about Compassion and Choices at this time. So he said he wanted to die. We had morphine. I gave him the morphine. He had pain. Morphine took the edge off the pain, but it never relieved the pain. And he kept getting worse and worse to the point where he wasn't bathing anymore, and he wasn't drinking anymore, and he was uncomfortable and in pain, and he wanted to go, and there was nothing we could do. He actually said to my daughter at one point, who was 25 at the time, he woke up from a nap, and he said, am I dead yet? And he wasn't kidding. He meant it. And my daughter said, no, no, you're not. You're still here, and he was really upset to hear that he was still here. So when he actually died, and it was a horrible experience for him and for me to watch my husband of 32 years wither away to nothing and then finally die, I felt like I had to do something. And so I was talking to some people, and they mentioned some older organizations that used to be around, and I eventually got hooked up with Compassion and Choices,
mm-hmm.
which coincidentally had this aid in dying bill that they were trying to get passed in New Jersey. And I signed on heart and soul to be as helpful as I can for this organization, because I believe in the process. I believe in giving people control and a sense of owning their life or what they want to do with their life when they are at the bitter end of their life and the battle is being lost.
So you yourself, I think you just mentioned you are a nurse, correct?
Yeah, I'm an OR nurse. Actually, I'm perioperative director at this time, and OR falls under it. My husband was an OR nurse as well.
So you speak, in essence, speak the language. You know.
Yes.
You know from the inside how things work in many, many different ways.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about, because in included in the essence, I think, of these choice and dying bills, and not only in Jersey, I did a program with a congregation last month. I think it was last month up in Hartford, because the Connecticut legislature is debating a similar bill. And I think there's something pending or possibly bubbling up in the state of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about when you were walking this walk, this walk with your husband, the power of choice, the ability to have, 'cause you used that word a couple of times.
Yes.
How important is the ability for you and an individual to have power and choice over their own life and death?
So I will first talk about it as a nurse. I see people in the OR, the most important thing we do as OR nurses is patient advocacy. So when a patient has had surgery, they can't speak for themselves. They're under sedation or heavy sedation. They're out of it, or they have general anesthesia. And so if somebody wants, for example, no blood to be given to them, if they're a Jehovah's Witness and they don't want any blood, my role as an OR nurse is to make sure the surgeon and the anesthesiologist know this before we go into the OR suite, and that we're all on the same page and we're all on board. This is what the patient wants. It's not about what I want or what the surgeon or the anesthesiologist want. This is what the patient wants. And if we're all okay with that and we're going to go forward with the procedure, all's well and good. And if not, we need to have some conversations about it. So that's my professional point of view, is that patient advocacy as an OR nurse is number one in my life. On a personal level, watching my husband wither away to nothing is horrendous. I mean, I'm, you know, a little bit shaken up just even talking to you, because it's a hard thing to watch a loved one fail. To describe it even more graphically, my husband had Crohn's disease, which is he had ileitis.
Right.
So, you know, gaining weight and being healthy and looking good was incredibly important to him his entire life. And he worked out to build up muscle. And he tried to eat to gain weight. And finally, in his middle ages, he started actually to put some weight on because the metabolism slows down. So this man, whose entire life focused on his body and working to build it up because of his Crohn's disease, to start failing and to watch his body become skin and bones, literally, at the end, is, you know, from that point of view, is just horrendous to watch your husband fail in that way. So personally, I firmly believe that people should have a choice. So I met an assemblyman when we were talking with the assemblyman in Trenton. And he said to me, for example, how do you know that somebody really has less than 6 months left to live. And he knows people who actually were told that and they live longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained to him that lots of people, the physicians don't have a glass ball, a crystal ball.
Right.
They really don't know exactly when you're going to die. It is a very good, educated, expertise-based guess that you have 6 months or less to live. But people who want to actually take this pill that will end your life aren't going to take that pill when they're told they have 6 months left to live. When they've fought the good fight, because everybody's going to stand up and fight the good fight, chemo, radiation, as I said before, and whatever else, like Farrah Fawcett went to Germany looking for something to save her life. When you're at the end of that battle and you realize it's just going, you're a losing battle, then that choice needs to come in. And if somebody doesn't want to take a pill or get a pill or do anything with that pill, that's their choice and that's fine. But if you don't have legislation protecting the physician, protecting the patient who takes the pill, then there's no sense of control and you just swim in a sinking ship and you're living the rest of your days like that. And that's not okay. My husband would have taken the pill.
Mm-hmm.
He absolutely would have taken that pill. And so for people who want that, it should be a viable option. And for people who don't want it, that's absolutely fine too. But nobody in my mind should have the right to not let somebody who wants to take the pill take the pill.
We're speaking with Debbie Dunn, a volunteer for Compassion and Choices, discussing the pending legislation in New Jersey and a choice in dying bill and the general subject of choice in dying. That conversation is now gaining so much traction around the United States of America. And a reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. And please join us with Kendall and together transforming the experience of aging. And we invite you again to learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, by visiting www.discoverkendall.org or giving them a call toll-free at 888-759-0128. You're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in the Delaware Valley outside of in Philly and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And you can reach us again on the show at Boomer Generation Radio at gmail.com. Debbie, in your walking through this walk in the last several years with your husband and being a volunteer for Compassion and Choices, I'm sure you have run across individuals will say, we empathize with this feeling. We empathize with struggle that people go through. But really, the decision to end one's life by taking this pill or taking this cocktail, that's really against the law. This is really God. It's in the hands of God. This shouldn't be up to legislatures or this, that, and the other thing. This is, goes beyond that. How have you dealt with that? I'm sure you've run into that.
Yes. The religious aspect is a personal choice as well. There are some people who believe in God who feel that this is okay for them to do too. So there's that end of it. And then, although people don't like to hear this, there are other people who question. They're agnostic. They question the existence of God, or they're atheists and they don't believe in God. So that is not an issue to them. But I have read a lot of information, and there are people who do believe in God who feel that God would be okay with this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a personal ideology framework with which everybody lives, and obviously people have to be comfortable with taking the pill. This, by the way, is not considered suicide. Your death certificate states that your death is related to whatever it is disease-wise that killed you.
Right. Right.
That's an important distinction to make as well. But it is not suicide. But, you know, you want to call that a thin line, you can call that a thin line. But I go back to the fact that some people believe that if there's a God, that God would be okay with it. And again, if someone's not for it and they feel that it's not right and God would be against something like this, that would be fine for them. But nobody should be so closed-minded that the way they believe and the way they think should be the way that everybody believes and thinks.
So once again, we come back to this idea of personal autonomy and personal choice. And before we start running out of time for this segment, I just want to ask you from your perspective, and we haven't met, so I don't know who, you know, your personal background, et cetera, but why do you think right now at this time in our country's history, this conversation is becoming so important? What's motivating this conversation, in your opinion?
I think that we've evolved as a society, and that's a big reason why. You mentioned that this is a boomer,
right.
You know, radio show, and a lot of people of that generation are open to these kinds of topics. Had this been brought up, you know, 50 years ago, I don't think it would have had the traction it has today.
Not at all.
In addition, we had Brittany Maynard, who I think everybody has heard about, Brittany Maynard, who went through some choices of her own, personal decisions of her own, who found compassion in choices, and she became, you know, very well known across the country. She's well publicized in TV shows and whatnot. She's been in the news a lot. That certainly has put this way out there in a very big way. She decided that she wanted compassion and choices to be well known through her, and that was her motive of doing this. This is my motive doing it. I will do whatever compassion and choices asks me to do in media, mm-hmm. because if you don't spread the word and educate people, then people think that this is a bad idea for very small reasons. They don't understand the full scope of it. When I've spoken to the nurses that I work with, initially, everybody was like, well, okay, that's interesting. But the more I talked about it, the more they were more aware and could actually understand why somebody would go to the depths of actually getting a pill that would end their lives. So it's education, and it's putting the word out there, and it's talking to people, and that's what's going on now. And with that, this motion of moving this bill forward in New Jersey especially, as well as other states that it is now being talked about, is gaining full traction.
And Debbie, from your perspective, not only somebody who has lived this, but also from your professional perspective as an OR nurse, how important is it for individuals to make sure they have up-to-date advanced directives and healthcare proxies so that somebody can speak for them if they are unable to speak?
It is very important because that is your word on paper for when you can't speak, when you can't say what it is you want done. If you're on a respirator, but you really, if you have thought about it in advance and you read about it and you learned about it, and then with that knowledge decided you don't want that for yourself. If you don't put that on paper and you end up on a respirator, you can be on a respirator for a very long time, because your family members don't have information to know what it is you would have liked. Hopefully you put on paper what it is you'd like, and you must speak to your family members, because if they're not on board with understanding what your decisions are and choices are, they're your mouth when you can't speak. It is very important that you think about all these things, talk to people who have advanced directives and living wills and healthcare proxies, and designate somebody to speak for you who you know and trust will be speaking the words that you would have if you could have.
Last question before we're just bumping up against to the end of this segment. Talk to me very quickly And I'm, this is maybe a tough question because everything is still so new. The impact of this journey, not only on you, the spouse, but on the family as well. There's always a focus on the patient. But my experience as a clergy person tells me, and my own, is that this also has a significant impact, this journey, on an entire family. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Well, obviously it's impacted me because I'm doing a lot of volunteer work for Compassion and Choices. And it makes me feel like I'm doing it in my husband's name, personally. My children are in complete agreement with Compassion and Choices, and they would happily participate as well. They don't live in New Jersey right now. My parents, my sister and her husband and her family, my brother and his wife and his family have all watched my husband turn to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It has heavily impacted them, and we had a Compassion and Choices in my house recently, and every one of my family members came who were able to come on that day. You know, it impacts the entire sphere of that one person's family and extended family.
We've been talking with Deborah Dunn, a volunteer for Compassion and Choices in New Jersey. We've been speaking a little bit about the pending piece of legislation in New Jersey, the Choice in Dying Bill, some of the other pieces of legislation around the country, and more importantly, the journey that she was on and her decision to volunteer for Compassion and Choices. I should mention to our audience as well that we're participating with 50andbeyond.com, one of our sponsors, for a community-wide forum, series of forum for baby boomers that are going to be starting in January. And January 14th at the Cherry Hill Library, we're going to be looking at this issue again on a small educational forum for the community with a representative from Compassion and Choices. And we're going to be opening it up to a Q&A and trying to educate more people about what this bill is all about and why the conversation is happening so frequently now across the country, and especially in the state of New Jersey, because it's just timely. It's our families, it's our loved ones, and again, as Debbie has correctly pointed out, and I thank you again, the questions about choice and what role an individual has to make choices and decisions about his or her own life. And by extension, obviously, his or her own death. So, Deborah Dunn, thank you very, very much for being with us on Boomer Generation Radio. I wish you continued success in your lobbying efforts. Take care. I admire your efforts. And again, thank you for giving of your time to be with us here this morning.
And thank you very much for having me. I very much enjoyed it.
Take care. You have a good day.
You too.
So that was Deborah Dunn from Compassion and Choices, this volunteer. And this subject it raises all kinds of personal, ethical, moral questions of whether a person has the right to make these decisions, whether physicians should write these prescriptions. One of our former guests, a cardiologist from Jersey, we were having a conversation, said that he is in favor of the bill, but wouldn't his moral fiber wouldn't allow him to write the prescription. So this is a conversation that has many, many levels, many, many nuances. And we're actually going to follow up on a different take of some of this conversation in our second segment. Right after, I want to remind you again of some of our friends here on Boomer Generation Radio. Not only 50andbeyond.com, who's going to be co-sponsoring these series of forums in the Cherry Hill area starting in January 14th, where, again, we're going to be discussing the Choice in Dying bill. And you can get more information about 50andbeyond.com by looking at their website, 50andbeyond.com. You can go to the website and download a digital copy of their magazine. 50andbeyond.com is basically, it's a one-stop shop for information regarding older adults, baby boomers, issues of health and wellness, travel tips, beauty tips, healthcare information, living options, in-home healthcare services, assisted living and dementia services. All of these and more are available to you on 50andbeyond.com. So I urge you to take a look at the website. 50andbeyond.com is on top of today's issues and concerns for baby boomers and the aging adult population. Go to them, 50andbeyond.com, on a weekly basis to see the latest posted information that is going to be beneficial to you and all who are 50 and beyond. We also want to mention, remind you of the Hecht Investment Group, a very good friend of ours, and also tell you that Peter Hecht from the Hecht Investment Group will be making one of his regular visits here to Boomer Generation Radio. I think he's scheduled for December the 16th. We're going to be talking a little bit about financial plans at the end of the year for baby boomers and moving forward. Hecht Investment Group of Janie Montgomery Scott, providing concierge financial consulting and planning services. They use a formal investment process as their foundation, and they assure us, and I can speak personally, that clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. As many of us know, in these very interesting times, there are few needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning, and the Hecht Investment Group provides experienced guidance and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. And you can contact the Hecht Investment Group toll-free at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. You can visit them at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. And they're also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And again, it gives us great pleasure to remind you that Peter Hecht was recognized by Philadelphia Magazine and New Jersey Magazine as a five-star wealth manager for 2013 and 2014. And Janie Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC. And finally, a reminder from another good friend of the show, Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice. And we'll be talking a little bit about some hospice issues coming up in a few seconds. But if you're concerned right now about your parents' failing memory or concerned about your parents' safety and not sure to where to turn for help, we encourage you to give SeniorWise a ring or look them up on the Internet. SeniorWise Geriatric Care Managers can provide a comprehensive assessment and care plan, help keep your loved ones safe at home, screen and monitor in-home services, and help you avoid costly mistakes. It also can ease your loved one's transition to a care facility if that is necessary. SeniorWise is a member of the Samaritan Family of Services, and you can speak with a SeniorWise geriatric care manager today by giving them a call at 856-552-5166. That's 856-552-5166. And you can log on to www.seniorwisecare.org. That's the SeniorWise Geriatric Care Manager Program from Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice, 856-552-5166. Hi, and welcome back to the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio this morning, brought to you by Kendall Outreach, serving the field of aging by raising public awareness and advocacy around the important issues of older adults through education and training and comprehensive, safe, and individualized long-term care practices. Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approach to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, and government agencies and related organizations since 1989. And to learn more about this, visit Kendall.org, K-E-N-D-A-L.org, and click on Outreach. We are pleased to welcome here on our second segment of Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in the Delaware Valley, Barbara Tobin. Barbara, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. Welcome to Boomer Generation Radio. It's a interesting morning. We're following up, and your expertise in palliative care and hospice care is very, very good complement to this very interesting conversation we had on the first segment, dealing with some of the issues regarding the pending legislation in New Jersey on the Choice in Dying bill. So your background is in palliative care and hospice care, correct?
Yes. I worked 10 years as a nurse at Chandler Hall Hospice in Newtown, inpatient hospice, and then until I retired 2 years ago, I worked at Pennsylvania Hospital in palliative care.
So there's a lot of questions because palliative care has become a very hot item right now. And I remember about a year ago, I think, maybe less, even the New York Times had a huge section on one of its Tuesday science sections on the growth of palliative care as a very powerful and important specialty now in medicine. And as I go out and talk around workshops dealing with end of life, there's a lot of questions about it. So Barbara, what is, give me a good definition of what palliative care is.
Palliative care is like a specialized medical care for people with serious illness. It does not have to be a terminal illness. The goal of palliative care is to provide patients with relief from the symptoms such as pain and stress of other symptoms, maybe shortness of breath, from the results of having that serious illness. A lot of people think palliative care is the same as hospice, but it isn't, because when people are getting palliative care, they are still getting curative treatment. So it goes on simultaneously with curative treatment, and it's also done by a team, usually a social worker, physician, chaplain, maybe psychologist. That's what palliative care is in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. And hospice care, from what you're just alluding to, if I'm understanding this correctly, if someone is getting palliative care, they're getting care that is designed to help cure whatever issue is being presented. But if you go into hospice care, and Debbie, our first guest, alluded to this, the treatment for curing this particular situation ceases. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Hospice care is someone has to have a prognosis, an estimated prognosis, no one knows for sure, of course, of 6 months or less to mm-hmm. live, and they usually give up curative care. However, there is some talk now about allowing people to be on hospice care and perhaps still get chemotherapy and radiation therapy, but that's not legislation yet or in Medicare's rules yet.
So the popular conception, and you alluded to this, is that palliative care is there to relieve pain. That there is, as one palliative care physician told me when we were having this conversation a while ago, he basically said, Richard, there is no need in the contemporary medical model for any human being to have to suffer excruciating pain. We have the ability to treat it. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah.
But you also mentioned not only pain management, but issues related to pain management, such as stress, et cetera. Is that why this team approach is so powerful?
Yes, it is, because inevitably there are a lot of psychosocial issues involved with an illness. There are family stresses. There are other symptoms. There may be care management, caregiver burden. There's more than just the patient, and that's the other thing, that the palliative care focuses on the whole family and not just the patient.
So we've had people here recently to talk about a shift in care, what they're calling patient-centered care, which sounds like what you're talking about a team approach, that a whole support, caring support team, almost like a individual caring community that takes care of an individual from not only their physical issues, but the psychological issues, the spiritual issues, and then the family systems issues with the social worker. So
is this
something that you're seeing evolving?
It is evolving. At Pennsylvania Hospital, where I worked, that it was a fairly new concept in the hospital setting, but it's also in the outpatient setting there. And another focus of palliative care, which I didn't mention yet, is also discussing the goals of care with the patient and the family early, before it becomes a crisis. Like even if you don't have a terminal illness, I mean, it doesn't hurt to talk about what you would want to do if you did get acutely ill and in danger of dying, rather than wait until a crisis occurs.
So this goals of care, I keep hearing this phrase too a lot. So, in other words, you're saying that one of the things that's evolving now is this team is going to sit down with a person and perhaps members of their family and say, okay, this is where you are on the continuum. Let's talk about the what ifs. What if you go this way? What if you go that way? What do you want? What don't you want? What are you afraid of? What are you not afraid of? What are you willing to deal with, and what are you not willing to deal with? Is this what you're talking about?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Yes, it's very much, and it's very important. And people have the concept that once they're going, you talk about goals of care or advanced directives, that that's the end, and it isn't. I mean, I'm in my 70s. I'm very healthy, but I have my everything written down because once you get in a hospital, the wheels go in the direction of everything, and you better know well ahead of time before that happens what you would want or not want, what your values are. Some people want to live until as long as possible, and other people say, no, I don't want to live if I have to be on a ventilator, if I have to be in the hospital. I want to be at home. Maybe my life will be shorter, but I will be at home and be comfortable rather than in a hospital surrounded by machines and strange people.
We keep hearing, and there are more and more articles being written about this, that people will do anything to stay home. That they really, there's this feeling growing, especially amongst baby boomers, I think, because we've seen so much of this with our own parents' generation, that it's always going to be preferably treated, cared for in our own home rather than in a facility. Did you start to find this in your career, especially towards the last couple of years of your career?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Some people say that until a push comes to shove.
Right.
You know, like they say, I want to be treated at home, and then when they get the first sign of illness, they're not even the first sign, but the first serious illness, and they're in the hospital, they'll say, oh, yes, do this. I don't think they always understand the implications of doing everything, but it's interesting because 70% of people say they would like to die at home, and yet 70% of people who die in the hospital. So.
No. I know the statistics are fairly obvious and well reported. We're speaking with Barbara Tobin, retired nurse, talking about issues of palliative care and hospice care and some of the differences here on Boomer Generation Radio. A reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed, as we've mentioned to you many times, to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you again to visit www.discoverkendall.org. That's www.discoverkendall.org, or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. Back to Barbara Tobin here on Boomer Generation Radio. Again, coming to you from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And a reminder that if you want to reach the show, email us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. Barbara, why is there still such hesitancy, I think, still about the word hospice? It's so popular. It's done so many wonderful things. It's all over the world. People I know, I'm sure you know, rave about it and experience how wonderful it was for a loved one. But yet there just still seems to be some reluctance on the part of families sometimes to say, yes, it's time for my loved one to enter hospice. Is it because it really is the end?
People are, I think in our society, we're a death denying society. We don't like to think about death, for one thing. But there are a lot of misconceptions about hospice. Some people think that it is, a euthanasia type event. I once had a family conference with a patient family who was considering admitting their loved one to the hospice, and we talked about what hospice was and wasn't. And at the end of the conversation, they said, "Well, when are you going to give her the shot to do her in?" You know, like that is still in people's mind. That
a loving family.
Because we're not treating a person, because we're not doing curative treatment. That means we're euthanizing people. And I think people also think it means giving up hope. Hope may be, you may be giving up hope for seeing your grandchild graduate from college, but there is hope for each day. There becomes hope for each day. The other misconception is that you can't change your mind. You can change your mind. You can be in hospice and decide you just want curative treatment, and you can get curative treatment if you make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think they can't keep their own physician, and they can still have their own physician. Some people feel like it's abandoning them. They feel like it's giving up. They see it as giving up and not. We talk so much, especially in cancer, about fighting that battle, and you better get in there and fight.
Right.
And they see hospice as giving up, and it's not really giving up. It's going in a different direction, but the direction is comfort and peace and support. And we are all going to die. That's
the rumor.
That's the rumor.
That's the rumor.
None of us get out of here alive.
That's what they tell
me. So how do you want to die? Basically, it's the bottom line.
In your experience, in the various institutions and places, in looking back in your career, and especially in these areas, end of life conversations, et cetera, what's been your experience of the role of religion and spirituality in a person's life?
I think it's important to some people, religion. I mean, I think we're all spiritual beings. I think even though some people will deny that, but I think spirituality can come through art, music, nature.
Right.
It doesn't have to be religion.
Correct.
My experience is that people do, they're big questions. What was my purpose in life? What was my meaning of life? Those are really big spiritual and religious questions that, hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're there.
Okay.
There's a sunspot religion. Probably somewhere.
Questions that people ask, and they're across the whether you say you believe or not.
Mm-hmm.
In a religious perspective.
Did you find that people who had some sort of spiritual underpinning, that their journey at the end of life was made more comfortable? Was it more peaceful, or what did it really, in the bottom line, really not make that much of a difference?
It depends on what kind of spirituality they had. I think if the spirituality involved living your life as fully as possible, and I think those people seem to have an easier time of it. And this is certainly anecdotal. It's not researched. People that have more of a fearing God type religion seem to have a harder time, especially if they felt they had a lot of sins that needed forgiving or hadn't felt forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have a harder time. I always said the people who seemed to me to have the easiest death were the Quakers, because I worked in a Quaker facility, and they had a lot of there were a lot of farmers, and they worked hard all their lives, and then they stopped working, and then they came to the hospice, and then they died. You know, it was, and it was always very peaceful, and I don't know if there's any truth to that, but that it seemed that way from my experience.
What was the power of love? In your experience, the power of love with an individual and a family as they face the end of their journey?
It was very, very important. It was wonderful to see a loving family with a patient who was dying. There seemed to be a lot of peace, a lot of sadness and grief.
Mm-hmm.
And when the families were the kind of people who could talk with each other and just say what they're feeling and not be afraid to say what they're feeling, it was much, much easier. It seemed like if there were things that hadn't been talked about, family secrets, issues that hadn't been dealt with, it seemed to make it much harder for people to let go, on both sides, for the patient to let go and for the family to let go.
So in your experience, Barbara, is there such a thing as a, quote, good death, unquote?
Yes.
What does it look like?
It looks like... the person has come to terms with knowing that they're dying, accepting it, not necessarily liking it, but surrendering, I guess is how I would put it. This is what I need to do. This is part of life. And having their symptoms well controlled, if they have pain, having that well controlled, having their families around them, having made peace with people, and peacefully sleeping away. You know, I have to say my father had a very good death. He was 92 when he died, and he had been very active until the last 6 months when he broke his hip. And he said to me, I feel like I'm going down a river, and people are waving to me. And I said, Dad, what do you think's happening? And he said, I think I'm dying. And I said to him, are you afraid? And he said, no. And he, you know, an hour, 2 hours later, he peacefully slipped away. And I hope I can die like that.
Wow, that's a great image. You know, that comes right out of the first thing that jumped in my mind when you mentioned that was the first chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes, which whose image is the rivers flowing into the sea.
Right.
And almost as if, you know, we are all part of something greater than our own self. I love that chapter because of that. It sort of like helps put things in perspective that you're not alone. You're part of something greater, and you're part of this eternal flow of nature in a sense. But you also mentioned this word surrender, which in the context has a sense, I think, of giving up. But when you say surrender, I don't think you're saying, or you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that a person, when they surrender, gives up life. It's just an acceptance, more of an acknowledgement that I've turned this corner and let me embrace it.
Let me embrace what's coming. Yeah, it's more like a letting go than giving up.
Okay.
And I think we tend in our society, especially, to be walking around with our fists clenched, you know, our jaws clenched, and sort of like, letting go and letting whatever is going to happen.
And
acknowledging this is part of life. It's, I always said to people, it's the other end of the spectrum. You know, birth, labor and birth is painful and hard, and you don't always know exactly when it's going to happen or how it's going to happen. And death is similar, just the other end.
No, the letting go image is really a very powerful one. And even in giving birth, you're letting go. A mom is letting go of literally, physically letting go of this entity. And the process of almost letting go of this other human being begins at the moment that they come out of that womb.
Right.
You don't realize it perhaps then, but in truth, that's the beginning of that second journey, that independent journey. In just the 2 minutes we have left in this segment, I just want to get your take, too, as we asked Debbie on the first segment. How important is it for people to have that conversation about my wishes, write that advance directive to get that healthcare proxy, and to constantly revise it. How important is it in today's society?
I think it's one of the most important things in a person's life. It really should start young. I mean, young, bad things happen to young people.
Right? People have mentioned that a person gets their driver's license, and that's the first part of that. That's when the first conversation should start.
Right. And everyone should know your physician, I think your clergy, your family, they should know your wishes, and they should be written down. And it's much easier if they're written down rather than someone says, oh, I always heard her say such and such. You know, and they should know where to find it they should have a copy. Your healthcare power of attorney should have a copy.
Who should have that copy? I know the physician, the nursing home, the assisted living facility, children, spouses, and...
Right. Yes. I give mine out to everyone.
and not to put it in the safe deposit box.
Right. Not in a safe deposit box. It has to be known. It has to be out there. Because, I mean, I have one ready. If I go to the hospital, I'm taking it with me. It's like, you know.
No. And most hospitals ask for it now.
Right. They ask for it. And not, you don't always follow up. You know, people say they have it, and then they get to the hospital, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out somewhere nobody knows where it is, so it's important to have it and know where it is and get it there.
So we've been talking with Barbara Tobin in this segment of Boomer Generation Radio, nurse dealing with issues of palliative care and hospice care. And I'm reminded that Boomer Generation Radio has been brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states, advocating and empowering older adults to reach their full potential, together to transform the experience of aging. And you can learn more about Kendall. We invite you to visit them at www.discoverkendall.org. And the toll-free number, again, is 888-759-0128. So, Barbara Tobin, we really want to thank you for sharing your experience and your stories here with us on this segment of Boomer Generation Radio. I wish you a great week, and to all of you, have a wonderful week. Stay safe, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday morning, 10 o'clock here on WWDB AM 860 for another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. Take care. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Barbara. Thank you.